Perry cathedrals are everywhere. All this talk of priestesses, temples, and lingams seems like just a fancy excuse to have casual sex by pretending like it's serious business. Perhaps just as there are cults around religion, so too are there cults around intimacy. But instead of monotheists, pantheists, and atheists, there are monogamists, polyamorists, and celibates. Each belief system comes with its own rituals, whether they be 12 steps, pujas, exclusivity, adultery, or arguing about money every night. And people like Patrick Carnes, Helen Fisher, and Kamala Devi are zealots who believe they found the one true intimacy. I try to stop my critical thinking, to use the four adjustments and turn judgment into compassion, to recognize the beauty of all these shame-free sexual revolutionaries, connecting and turning an ordinary space into something sacred. Perhaps a puja is no different and much healthier than drinking alcohol on a date. It's a way for people to lower their inhibitions and let go a little with one another. And that's when I get what this is all about. Thank you, Scott Katamas. There's a disparity between the masculine desire for sex, which tends to be more carnal and ego-based, and the feminine desire for sex, which can be more emotional and spiritual. So if swinging is for horny men, then this scene is for sensual women. Orgies are for ethical sluts. Pujas are for goddesses. Same destination, different ritual. I look down and notice a few pieces of popcorn on the ground. I can't leave these sacrilegious foodstuffs on a sanctified floor. They're virgins. They don't belong here. I pick them up and look for somewhere to throw them out, but I don't want to disturb the puja again. I could just eat them, though I don't want Abraham Lincoln's toe fungus in my digestive system. I glance at him, and his mouth is hinged open, moaning appreciatively as the old tantrika massages him. I conceal the offending popcorn in my pocket, and instantly the dictator returns. However, she's forgotten to bring the benevolence. I told you not to eat here. Her eyes bug out of her skull and bore into mine with what appears to be hatred. She has shape-shifted from priestess to demon. Devi, I realize, is just one letter away from devil. You're not respecting my puja. Your energy is interfering with my experience and the energy in the room, so I'm going to have to ask you to leave. I was just cleaning the temple floor, I say as I hold her gaze. And what's wrong with my energy? It's not like I can control it. I've never had anyone insult my energy before. I actually think it's worse than being called ugly. After all, you can't hide your energy, or go on an energy diet, or get your energy surgically altered. Even in a room full of blind people, you're still a monster. We can discuss this tomorrow, she snaps, but right now, you need to leave. I want to stay and see what happens next, but I heave a sigh and rise to my feet. She's right. These people need to feel comfortable getting naked and weird together without some overly clothed journalist eating junk food in the corner and silently mocking them. This is truly the blackest day of my life. I've been kicked out of an orgy for eating popcorn. I rise to my feet and walk out to the picnic tables on the patio. Fortunately, there are big glass windows. I can't hear the people inside, but at least I can see them. So I sit forlorn on top of a table and watch, the cool night air biting my face. I'm a grounded teenager again, sent to my room without dinner and forbidden from playing with girls. Gradually, the massages become more erotic. Kamala starts twirling and dancing through the writhing foursomes ecstatically, her arms outstretched like she's Julie Andrews in The Sound of Music. For a moment, the spectacle looks otherworldly and transcendent. But when the orbiter I met in the hot tub whips out his dick and masturbates above Diana, one of the reluctant poly wives, until he comes all over her enormous breasts, the entire facade of sacredness comes toppling down for me. It looks more like a scene from a gonzo porn film. If this is polyamory, then it's not for me. Not only would I prefer monogamy with Ingrid to doing the sexual hokey-pokey with a bunch of self-appointed deities every night, but I'd probably be banned from the scene entirely after a few more pujas. because I've done some desperate things in my life to get laid, but I've never faked a spiritual belief. Chapter 11. You should have talked to me first, Lawrence says. I would have warned you to stay away from the World Polyamory Association or any of those kinds of events. They're organized by these New Age people from Maui, and the batshit crazy types leech onto them. Lawrence is a meditation and sexuality teacher. He's tall with a shaved head and is so healthy his face glows as if he swallowed a light bulb. I'd met him once before at a party, where I introduced him to my friend Leah, a girl-next-door type with a wholesome face you could gaze at for hours. Leah called me afterward and said that on her first date with him, she had the best night of orgasms of her life. I haven't seen either of them since, but evidently those orgasms produce so much oxytocin that 4 years later, they're still dating. It's my first open relationship, Leah tells me, beaming. I ask them how it developed, and it turns out that just like Tall with his wife, Lawrence initially gave, and continues to give, Leah more freedom than he takes himself, so he can teach her a lack of fear and possessiveness by example. We're sitting on the patio of a pizza restaurant in Los Angeles, where I'm attending my first polyamory meetup group. I returned home from the conference disappointed and discouraged, but after digging deeper, I found that there's more to the polyamory scene than pujas and priestesses. And at this meetup, that's certainly the case. More than half the attendees are from a completely different poly offshoot, the BDSM scene, bondage and discipline, dominance and submission, and sadism and masochism. Like the conference attendees, most of the people here are over 40, but instead of wearing togas and sarongs, they're clad in vinyl and leather. Instead of goddesses and priestesses, they're masters and mistresses. Instead of worshipping the light, they worship the darkness. To my surprise, among them are Lawrence and Leah, who came to meet one of Lawrence's students. So I've been asking them about the polyamory conference, trying to get some perspective on what planet I was on. I don't understand what pujas have to do with polyamory, I tell Lawrence. It doesn't even matter whether the participants are in relationships or not. At the end of the day, what you saw there is a specific type of polyamory, he explains, tantra polyamory. Before the conference, I thought tantra was the practice of holding out on having an orgasm during sex in hope of a bigger, better, longer high. Since the conference, I have no clue what it is. Kamala Devi defined tantra as life itself, and the orbiter definitely wasn't denying himself release when he shot all over that woman's breasts. So in a nutshell, I asked Lawrence, what is tantra to these people? What they call tantra, he replies, is basically an American phenomenon invented as a way of talking about sex without using the word sex. So far, Lawrence is the first person I've met in this world who I feel like I can relate to, who doesn't start conversations with namaste and end them by asking about ETs. Because of all the immoral connotations of sex, he continues, they make it into something divine and polite instead of physical and passionate. I think this is because a lot of the gurus know that most women need an emotional connection to have sex, and spirituality is the quickest, deepest way there. Unfortunately, Leah adds, some of the women are just replacing one type of predator with another. Lawrence used to work with this one tantric sex guru who told women his dick was the godhead, and they had to open up and receive it to be awakened. He called his sperm the nectar of the gods. Afterward, a lot of the women felt deceived and used. Since the conference, I'd been feeling guilty for just dipping my toe in the water of the scene, rather than immersing myself before forming a conclusion. After all, pujas are the closest thing I've seen to free love in my life. But after talking to Leah and Lawrence, it's clear that what I saw didn't actually represent polyamory, just one of its many branches. But at least I learned that there are accessible communities where sex and love are seen as free and joyous, not possessive and pathological. As we're speaking, a heavy-set, deep-voiced African-American man standing nearby extends a thick hand and introduces himself as Orpheus Black. He's with three women, one he introduces as his slave, another as his partner, and a third as one of his three wives. He tells me that since marrying multiple people can come with a one-year prison sentence in California, he committed to two of those wives in a pagan ritual known as a hand fasting ceremony. With his wives, girlfriends, and submissives, Orpheus comes across like a master yod, so I respectfully blitz him with questions, hoping to learn what I'd wanted to at the conference. "I'm trying to put together a house like yours," I explain. "Do you have any advice on how to make it work?" He lets out a long, low chuckle, then leans in conspiratorially. "It's a full-time job. You have to be the leader. You can't show any weakness or doubt, or you'll get eaten alive." That doesn't sound like much fun. "But if you can't show vulnerability, then you don't really have any intimacy," I respond, sounding a little too much like Joan. "What if, instead of a master-slave thing, I want everyone to be equals?" "No matter how you do it, all the women need to be equals on some level," Orpheus responds. "The key is to make sure you don't have more feelings for one than the other. The other key is to sell them on the concept of the future, but ground them in reality." "So what is the future?" "Family." He says the word powerfully, then crosses his arms over his chest and nods with deep assurance. "You have to make sure they all know you're a family, and nothing ever supersedes the family. The mantra should be doing what's best for the community, not for the individual." The relationship he's describing seems even more restrictive than a monogamous one. Perhaps that's because restraints, rules, punishments, and power are integral to the BDSM community. And while hog-tying people, whipping them, and taking them for walks on a collar and leash may be fun for variety, they're not my kink. I'm not a top or a bottom. I'm a middle. Why is it that in order to escape monogamy, I have to look so far out on the fringes? Or are there many more people doing this, but hiding in shame, scared of the consequences to their career, family, or reputation if they're outed? I drive home discouraged, worried that I'm never going to find what I'm looking for, or a place where I fit in, or more people for my pod with Belle. That night, I dream I'm in the back row at a magic show with Rick Rubin. Ingrid is there, but she's in the front row. Afterward, I sit in my car, waiting for Ingrid to arrive so we can talk about the performance, but she never appears. I wake up covered in sweat and filled with dread that I made a bad decision, that I've lost Ingrid forever. All the pain I never felt after Ingrid moved out suddenly overwhelms me. I look at the survivor, surviving on my ledge as proof that I do have a heart, and sink into a deep melancholy. I've officially tipped to the other side of ambivalence. Instead of wondering whether to leave Ingrid, now I'm wondering if I should have stayed. I consider reaching out and telling her I want to forget this whole search and just be with her, that the security of the cage is better than the freedom of the wild. But I've learned enough to know that these are just the thoughts of an ambivalent, manifestations of fear and loneliness from my failure so far to find what I left to look for. All that would happen is we'd begin the love avoidance cycle all over again. For most men, what's tougher than breaking up is the moment when their ex finally falls out of love with them and lets go. Perhaps because it triggers a childhood fear, a psychological terror of losing the first woman whose love they needed, their mother. And so, as Sheila would recommend, I let myself feel the pain, the loneliness, and the fear, using all my strength as the days pass to keep from giving in and reaching out to Ingrid. In the meantime, I continue to attend occasional polyamory and sex-positive events, but without much luck or any adventure I'd actually want to take part in. As the pain turns to mourning, and the mourning turns to acceptance, I decide to stop going to them altogether. And that's when I finally find the scene I'm looking for. Not at a polyamory meetup, but in the laundry room of Seth MacFarlane's house. Chapter 12. Entry from Ingrid's journal. Unsent letter.
Dear Neil, I was hoping that we'd meet each other at the end of this hard road, but as the days pass, I see that our roads won't meet again. I've been scared, hoping you could save me and take me away from this road onto yours, but it hasn't happened. I didn't think that this was something that was going to come up, but I have met someone. Meeting this new person was a complete accident. I don't know what it is, but I really like him. At first, I thought I could have some fun with him and nothing would come of it. Maybe I'll get tired of him and stop answering his calls. But as I'm spending time with him, I realize this is a person I cannot just use like a rag doll. I can tell he likes me a lot. Seems too soon to know, but my intuition is very strong. I would like to give him a chance. To be honest, I'm completely terrified. I don't want to be in another relationship for a while. But at the same time, it feels right for some reason. Sometimes I wish you would come and take me away, but as the hours go by, I look back and see you so far away, almost like a blur in the distance. I'm sorry we've gone through this. I really wish you the best in life, and I hope you will find someone who can make you as happy as you made me. And I do mean it. With you, I was the happiest I ever was. Goodbye, Ingrid.
Stage 2. Swapping. Every totalitarian society, no matter how strict, has had its underground. In fact, two undergrounds. There's the underground involved in political resistance, and the underground involved in preserving beauty and fun, which is to say, preserving the human spirit. Tom Robbins, Still Life with Woodpecker.
Chapter 13. Nicole reminds me of a shorter, more conservative, even skinnier version of Ingrid. She's 5'4" and wearing what looks like a blue prom dress, her shoulder blades jutting over the top like the frame of a kite. She's a lawyer visiting from San Francisco, the kind of girl you marry and take home to mom, unless your mom is like mine. And I've known her for only half an hour. We're at a Japanese restaurant with a mutual friend, a film producer named Randy. He and his wife have invited us to join them for dinner, followed by a party at the Hollywood Hills home of Seth MacFarlane, the creator of Family Guy. Randy's wife, Jessica, is naturally full-lipped and voluptuous. Smoldering would be a word to describe her. Uptight would be another. When I tell them that I'm looking for an open-minded partner, she scowls and interjects, "I would never have a threesome." "Why?" I ask. Her vehemence takes me by surprise. "It's just that Randy and I love each other very much, and our love is real, and those are not the kinds of things you do when you're married." Her words send a chill up my spine. She's verbalized my fear that marriage means the end of fun, that the things a woman will do with a random guy she meets in Cabo are actually more fun than the thing she'll do with a man spending the rest of his life with her. My head drops into my hand before I can stop it. Randy looks as disappointed as I do, but conceals it slightly better. "What's wrong?" she asks. "Look at Randy," I tell her. "He's dying inside. No one wants to hear that his sex life with you would be better if he hadn't married you." Randy avoids eye contact with her, and the fight that will occur later if he agrees with me. "So if you weren't married, would you, if the circumstances were right and it just happened, ever have a threesome?" She doesn't say anything, but a smile flickers across her lips. "You would," I exclaim. Something in me is trying to prove a point. "So let me ask you then, if a man's need for sexual variety isn't met in wedlock, what needs of yours aren't fulfilled in your relationship?" Even the word wedlock sounds more like a prison sentence than a free choice motivated by love. "I'd say," she responds, "the needs that most women don't get fulfilled are for emotional connection and emotional support. But I don't look to get those needs fulfilled entirely by Randy." "See? And that's where I'm having a problem. At least you can get those needs met by having emotional connections with family and friends outside your relationship. But with sexual needs, you're stuck trying to get them all met by just one person. And if you try to get them from anyone else, you're pond scum." That's when Nicole turns slowly, gazes at me with soft blue eyes, and says quietly, I couldn't agree more. Really? I just look like a good girl on the outside, she tells me. It would be great if you could talk my wife into a threesome, Randy whispers as we wander around McFarland's backyard an hour later. It is not a small party. There are ice sculptures, porta-potties, a full orchestra, and lots of thin, awkward, six-foot-tall women. Nicole stays close to me the whole time, and gradually, the air around us charges. She makes a little more eye contact than she needs to, and laughs at even the bad jokes I make. These are known in the game as indicators of interest, and for the first time since I broke up with Ingrid, they're coming from a woman who just may be open to being open. I take her hand and lead her to an outdoor couch as McFarlane croons Luck Be a Lady in front of the orchestra. For some reason, Randy follows us and sits next to Nicole. I'm not sure if he's there to protect her or if he's just completely oblivious. While whispering in Nicole's ear, I poke Randy's leg with my hand to signal him to make an exit. He sits there unreactive, as if absorbed by something he's thinking. Do you think he's going to leave so we can kiss? I ask Nicole. I don't think he'd leave if we started fucking, she replies. What's rare about Nicole is that she doesn't seem to have any hang-ups about sex. And that's the kind of woman I've been hoping to find, one who's free of the sexual shame that parents heap on their daughters as soon as they're old enough to ask why boys look different down there. I remember one night I was sitting in a hot tub with a divorced man who was complaining about his dating difficulties as his two preteen daughters splashed around him. Boys are weird, his eldest said in response to a comment he made. He looked at her approvingly and told me, they're not dating anyone until they're 30. His youngest daughter responded, I'm going to be a single pug lady. And that's when I realized that guys bring their dating problems on themselves. They program their daughter with an aversion to men and sex for fear that she'll meet someone just like her father. Then they meet someone else's daughter and expect her to just jump into bed without anxiety or reservation. I run my hand through Nicole's hair and we start making out. As the kissing intensifies and hands begin wandering, Randy sits still next to us, like some sort of Rodin sculpture, the voyeur. I pry my lips off Nicole's and tell Randy, we're going to take a lap, then let's all leave. Inside McFarlane's house, Nicole and I try the handles of various rooms, but they're all locked. This is clearly not his first party. Then I spot a glass window, and through it, a laundry room. Fortunately, the door is unlocked. We slip inside and close the door behind us. I switch the light off so no one can see through the window. Then I throw Nicole against the door, reach under her dress, and massage her through her panties. She arches her back and moans, then starts fiddling with the buttons of my pants. Compared to the sacred sex at the World Polyamory Association conference, dirty, furtive, and spontaneous sex feels a lot more meaningful. Many women think that if they put out too quickly, their partner won't respect them. This is not the case. It's not about waiting for a certain quantity of time before having sex. It's about waiting for a certain quality of connection. And I already like Nicole enough to hope she'll consider being my consensually non-monogamous, polyamorous, pluralistic, multiple-relating primary partner. Maybe she'll be interested in moving into the free love house with Belle and me. As she kneels and goes down on me, I reach into my back pocket and pull out a condom. And that's when it happens. She removes her lips, gazes up at me innocently, and says, I can't have sex with you, unless my boyfriend's here. It takes a moment for the meaning of the words to register in my brain. It's not a sentence I've heard before. I'm more used to someone saying, I can't have sex with you because I have a boyfriend. I repeat the word like a cry of pain. Boyfriend? Someone else is already living my dream with her. We're in an open relationship, she responds, but I'm not allowed to fuck anyone without him there. The disappointment on my face must be clear, because she adds, but when we do fuck, it's going to be very, very good. She slides her mouth around me again. Is it okay if I come? I ask. I'm not sure why I'm checking for permission. Maybe I need to call her boyfriend and make sure it's okay with him, too. Of course, she replies. Good answer. I watch her work, but I'm so confused and let down that it's hard to stay in the moment. I remember watching the documentary, Anatomy of Sex. It explains that when the penis is limp, that's when it's actually tense. The muscles are constricted. When it gets aroused, the penis relaxes, and this allows blood to enter, which expands the spongy tissue and creates the erection. So you need to be relaxed to get hard. You can't get hard when you're tense. And I'm tense, because I finally found someone open-minded who I can see myself dating. And she's taken. Unable to perform, I zip up. I think I was meant to meet you, I tell her as we sneak out of the room. I've been thinking a lot about open relationships lately. Are you in the lifestyle? She asks, speaking the words cautiously, probingly. What do you mean by the lifestyle? I hate that name, she says. It's swinging. Wouldn't I need a girlfriend to swing? Not necessarily. Do you know about the Lifestyle Lounge? No. It's a website my boyfriend and I belong to. You can find someone there. Is that where all the sane ones have been hiding? I ask. They're actually hiding at Bliss, she responds. And they're really hot. We're going in a couple of weeks. You should come with us. Will there be poojas there? I ask, just to make sure. What are poojas? Great, I tell her. I'm in. Chapter 14. Thank you again for last night and for respecting my boundaries. Nicole texts as she boards a plane home to San Francisco the following day. I'm looking forward to getting together again, this time with James. I had hoped to be on the other side of the relationship, and I'm not sure I'm comfortable with a guy in the room, even if he's just watching. Especially if he's watching. But Shama Helena did advise me to observe some relationships, and this may be a chance to do that. Unfortunately, I get the chance sooner than I expected. 2 hours later, Nicole texts and says we need to talk. It's never a good sign when someone you just had sexual contact with needs to talk. The only thing I can imagine is that she has an STI she didn't tell me about. I call and ask what's wrong. I just had a discussion about trust with James, and I crossed some boundaries with you that I shouldn't have, she tells me, distraught. I thought you had an open relationship. Maybe their relationship isn't actually open, but just ajar. Actually, our agreement was that I wasn't supposed to have sex or oral sex, she confesses. I didn't think it would be that big of a problem for him, but when I started telling him what happened, he got really pissed. I honestly think this could be the end. Because he wasn't there, it wasn't okay. He says if I loved him, I wouldn't have done that. The fact that it started in the laundry room made it seem cheaper to him, and he's mad that I jeopardized the relationship in that way. She pauses. And what makes it worse is that we're lawyers, so contracts are important. An hour later, he texts. Neil, James here. You shouldn't feel bad about anything you did. I don't. I need to think through some things. Unconditional trust is vital when you live life the way we've chosen. Nicole violated my trust, and that's something I need to process. So far, it sounds like their open relationship has just as much drama as a closed relationship, and the drama is about the same thing, trust. Perhaps the reason friendships tend to last longer than relationships is that most of them don't come with rigid rules and exclusivity clauses. A minute later, James texts again. I'm not sure where this goes next, and I don't know where you want this to go. That's just something we all need to figure out together. I will text you once I've worked it through on my end. The word together strikes me as oddly inclusive. It almost sounds as if I have the option of being involved in their relationship. Whatever the case may be, I hope it hasn't ruined my chances of going to Bliss. Chapter 15. swinging is a victim of its own success. When most people think of marriage with sexual freedom, swinging is the first word that comes to mind. However, the public relations campaign against swinging has been so complete and thorough that the word alone evokes derision rather than concupiscence. Even rock groupies have a better reputation. The main strikes against swinging are, first of all, its apocryphal depiction as an activity mostly for old, out of shape, tastelessly attired, and otherwise dull suburban couples. And second, the idea that swing clubs are crawling with diseases. Partly for these reasons, adherents have attempted to mitigate the stigma by renaming their scene the lifestyle instead. In swinging's defense, the judgment that only good-looking people are allowed to have pleasure is more a condemnation of the accuser than the accused. As for STIs, researchers say that HIV hasn't been any more prevalent among swingers than the general population. As one researcher put it, it's used as a moral argument, but it's not a scientific one. If all parties were like Bliss, however, swingers would be envied instead of mocked. Nicole sits at a Chinese restaurant in the Las Vegas Palms Casino, next to a man who I presume is James. He makes strong eye contact and shakes my hand firmly. It's an overly masculine greeting, formal and slightly self-conscious. Evidently, it is customary for strangers who've shared the same woman to greet each other like gunslingers before a shootout. Though he's in his mid-30s, James is dressed more like he's in his mid-20s, with a garish-fitted t-shirt and factory-faded jeans. He's tall, with close-cropped blonde hair and a solid, broad frame, which seems to be more a result of genetics than the gym. So though he's big, he doesn't look like he'd last long in a fight, which is a good sign, since he may not be happy that Nicole and I have been texting constantly since we met. Out of respect, however, I've made sure to text him once for every 5 she and I send. "I just want to let you know there's no bad blood between you and me at all," he says. As a result of what happened, Nicole and I have actually improved our communication and strengthened our relationship. "Well, I'm glad that's resolved, I think, so I can have sex with your girlfriend now." We're soon joined by 2 couples, each with men who dress too young for their age and women who look like they stepped off the pages of Maxim. One is a sculpted, statuesque, raven-haired woman. The other is a living Barbie doll who introduces herself as Chelsea. Chelsea is tanned bronze, dyed blonde, and toned tight. She has had 1 surgery, bringing her to a D cup. The rest comes from hard work. I soon learned that she's the product of at least 5 hours a day of dedication to her appearance, 365 days a year, for the last 15 years of her life. That's more than 27,375 hours of perfection and hundreds of thousands of dollars in makeup, manicures, clothing, shoes, doctors, hairdressers, estheticians, and trainers. Beauty like this is an addiction, catering to a masculine fantasy that only gets more impossible to match every decade as photo painting, then airbrushing, then photoshopping, then photo editing apps keep raising the bar in the endless arms race of female perfection. I'm clearly the weak link here, and as a solo male, perhaps even persona non grata. Fortunately, Nicole flew an old friend of hers into town, who, she says with a suggestive smile, can be my special date. As everyone settles in, James asks about my last relationship. It seems like he's testing me, trying to gauge what kind of person I am, determining if I'm someone worthy of sleeping with his girlfriend. I tell him the truth, that I wanted to open it up, but Ingrid had no interest. "I think the mistake you made with her," Nicole jumps in, "is that you made it all about you wanting to be with other people. You should have made it instead about wanting to have sexual adventures together. This way, you can include her, rather than making it seem like a failing on her part. That's what worked on me." She's right. I was selfish with Ingrid. I just wanted my own pleasure, regardless of how much pain it would cause her. Perhaps if instead I'd wanted to do something that would have added to her life and to our relationship, she would have been more open to it. Or perhaps not. But it definitely would have been a better way to go about it. Like many people in the lifestyle, James and Nicole tell me they never thought they were going to be part of it. They grew up believing in the marriage myth. Exclusive, happy, until death. So before ever meeting, they married other people, but found the reality of it more life-draining than life-affirming. Everyone at this table, Nicole says, and almost everyone I know in the lifestyle, is either divorced or got out of a really long traditional relationship beforehand. You kind of need to get that first marriage or big deal relationship out of your system before you can come around to the truth that having sex with someone else has no effect on your love for each other. If anything, it can add to it. She tells me she met James at the law office where they work. After they dated for a few months, he took her to a strip club for her birthday, which excited her enough to want to try swinging. At first, they went to public swing clubs, but they had trouble finding couples they liked. Then, they started exploring the swinger personals, where they found couples they enjoyed spending time in and out of bed with. And finally, they discovered Bliss, which requires couples to submit photographs and an application for review before allowing them access to the members-only parties it throws at mansions, clubs, and resorts. No one we work with knows we do this, James tells me. If anyone found my phone, they'd freak out if they saw the messages. Half of them are from guys in the lifestyle, talking about their girlfriend's menstrual cycle and saying they can't come out to party for a few days. When a waitress arrives to take our order, James asks, "Should we just share everything?" I'm not in a sharing mood, the raven-haired woman says as her boyfriend sits sulking beside her. It's the first time she's spoken since I arrived. Put the two of us on a separate check. James leans in and whispers to me. They've been arguing all day, so we can't take them out with us tonight. In the swinger community, you'll see couples fighting, throwing drinks at each other, or running off blindly into the street. The thing about swinging is that it strengthens good relationships and destroys bad ones. Chelsea and her fiancé, Tommy, a spiky-haired jock wearing an untucked burgundy dress shirt, seem more ready for the night's adventure. "We're new to the lifestyle, but we don't go to vanilla clubs or parties anymore," Chelsea tells me as Tommy gazes hungrily at her, apparently committing covert sexualized violence. "At lifestyle events, everyone's cooler and more fun and more comfortable with themselves, and the girls aren't catty and jealous of each other, like in the vanilla world." That word, vanilla, comes up often in the conversation, always with disdain. The term refers to people who are not in the lifestyle. When it's mentioned, I laugh and joke back about those lame vanillas who ruin everything. But inside, I wonder, my vanilla? I think about Belle, the Australian woman who's coming to stay with me. I could probably share her. And I'm going to meet Anne, the nudist in Paris, in a couple of weeks. I could swap her for Chelsea. But sitting here, looking at James and Tommy, I just can't imagine feeling compersion while watching them violate Ingrid's every orifice as she gushes with orgasm after orgasm. I think back to my conversation with Shama Helena. If I want true freedom, I need to accept that the path leading there is going to be one of discomfort and vulnerability. "So where's my date?" I ask Nicole. "She's coming, you'll see." The anticipation is killing me. Blind dates are awkward enough, but blind swinger dates are even more stressful. I wonder how I'm supposed to greet her. "I'm looking forward to sharing you tonight." As we move through the lobby after dinner, Nicole and James greet various porn star-looking women, all of them Bliss members, walking with a deadly confident swagger that actually does make the tourists around them seem vanilla. Some non-lifestyle clubgoers are wearing equally revealing outfits, but the Bliss people seem to be owning their sexuality rather than just trying it on for the night. The pariah couple break away to deal with their drama as we take the elevator to Chelsea's suite so the women can change. I can't imagine how they could possibly get any sexier until I see the room. which looks like a Victoria's Secret store. There's lingerie, makeup, perfume, shoes, and lotions everywhere. Tommy is in the sex toy business, so his contributions to the tableau are duffel bags and briefcases full of his merchandise, plus a camera on a tripod with professional lighting equipment next to it. Everything shamed in rehab is here in full splendor. It looks like a porn set, I tell James. What you're going to see tonight is better than that, he replies. You'll never want to watch porn again. Chelsea gives Nicole a Victoria's Secret gift bag while Tommy pops open the champagne. This is swinger foreplay. Though Tommy seems a bit fanatical, I'm much more comfortable in this scene than at the puja. Instead of dressing sex up in worship and religion, they're dressing it up in lingerie and champagne. Suddenly, there's a knock on the door. That's her, Nicole says in a sing-song voice. My heart leaps into my throat. What if she isn't attracted to me? What if I'm not attracted to her? What if no one is attracted to us? What if? Don't worry, Nicole adds intuitively. It's her first time at one of these parties, too. Instantly, I feel better. The door opens, revealing a tall woman with metallic red hair who looks like she belongs on the cover of a fashion magazine. She has pixie-like features with an almost imperceptible dusting of freckles, smoky black eyeshadow, and full, sensuous lips. Her hair is cut short and swept just above her right eye. It's a powerful beauty that's simultaneously mainstream and alternative, masculine and feminine, young and old. Most strikingly of all, I know her. Sage? I ask. I'd seen her only once before, but I never forgot her. I was interviewing a band in New York for Rolling Stone, and she was hanging out with them. We barely spoke a word to each other, but she had an angelic glow to her, like a patron saint of alcoholic rock stars, that haunted me long afterward. She squeals in delight, wraps her arms around my neck, and presses her body against mine. Either she remembers me too, or she's just really friendly. I breathe in her heat, her moisturizer, her hair pomade. This is going to be a good night. Chapter 16. As Chelsea, Sage, and Nicole parade to the casino's club in their high heels and microskirts, every head turns. Even the dealers crane their necks to catch a glimpse. It's unclear whether they're looking because they think the women are attractive or prostitutes or both, but it doesn't matter. In this moment, we are Vegas. I trail behind them with James and Tommy, who are enjoying the wake their partners are creating. God, look at her, Tommy says, lusting after Chelsea. He runs a hand through his obsidian black hair, which is so gelled I can practically hear it crinkle. I'm going to marry her. I can't believe how lucky I am. A freakishly tall man and his dolled-up wife fall into step with us. My girl and I married 16 years ago, and we've been in the lifestyle the whole time, he tells us proudly. Check out her body. What a great body. Swinging is definitely a step closer to the solution I'm looking for. Instead of lusting after other women, these guys still lust after the one they're with. And rather than letting themselves go, the couple stay in shape because they know they're going to be naked in front of strangers. Perhaps swinging is the fountain of youth, a formula for escaping the monotony of growing older together and the loss of sexuality that comes with work, parenting, familiarity, and increasing responsibilities. Because despite the odds, after years together, these couples seem to have all three of Helen Fisher's drives for sex, romantic love, and deep attachment still running strong with each other. Soon we arrive at our destination, a dance club with a long line outside. As a beautiful bliss promoter whisks us past the velvet ropes, the tall swinger who joined us pleads with his wife. Honey, those two girls I told you about are already inside. Can I fuck them tonight? Okay, maybe they do still lust after other women, but at least they get permission first. Couples in the lifestyle don't merely go to clubs and hotels. Instead, they stage what they call takeovers. This involves invading a public space with rampant sexual energy and shocking the vanillas. While they don't swap there, they make plans and secure invitations for hookups afterward and get to feel cool and one-up in the meantime. The real swinging tonight, James tells me as we join a huge coterie of Bliss members inside, will be taking place at private parties in select hotel rooms later. On the dance floor, a blonde in a tight sequined silver dress is undulating so suggestively that my heart rate instantly spikes. Take the richest, most confident, most famous man in the world, and he's no match for a beautiful woman in the throes of a dance that oozes sexual energy. This is why fortunes are lost, families are torn apart, and wars are fought. I feel comfortable here, James says. These are my kind of people. Within moments, our dates have joined the enchantress on the dance floor. Conventional femininity seems amplified here, while conventional masculinity is tempered. Among their fellow swingers, the women feel safer being sexual and being appreciated for it than at vanilla events. Guys aren't ogling or groping or chasing or hitting on them. And as Chelsea said, women aren't scowling at them as if they're competition. My eyes lock on Sage, who's dancing with her legs splayed and her hips possessed, as if inviting lust to enter without knocking. Moments later, she walks over with the enchantress from the dance floor in tow. "Oh my God, your girl is so sexy," the blonde says. Her hands are all over Sage. She points to a short woman in a bridal veil, who's standing nearby with an even shorter man in a tuxedo. "See my friends over there? They're getting married tomorrow. Can you fuck her hard tonight? She needs to get fucked." "We'll see what the night brings," I respond, certain that I've died and gone to relationship heaven. Sadly, I wouldn't be the only guy in Vegas to have fucked a bachelorette the night before her wedding. As the blonde sashays away, Sage leans in close until her cheek is grazing mine. "If I'm dating someone," she says, "I don't want to be with other guys." "Really?" I'm shocked. I hope she's not another monogamous one. If someone I'm with were to allow that to happen, I'd consider it unmanly. "Then why did you come here?" "I just got out of a relationship, and I haven't seen Nicole in forever. So she brought me out here to have some fun and see the scene." "I actually just broke up too," I tell her. Her tongue flits alluringly between her lips, and she tells me about her last relationship. She dated a guy who was trying to create what he called a circle, a group relationship consisting of himself, Sage, and two other women. It sounds very Father Yod-like. However, he eventually became obsessed with one of the women, broke up with everyone else, started dating her exclusively, and recently married her. Evidently, a line was preferable to a circle for him. I'm relieved that Sage is actually open to alternative relationships. Suddenly, the world of Joan's office seems very far away. Here, there's a different kind of normal, where it's Joan who would be shamed for being so aggressively vanilla, a counter-sexual revolutionary. I lead Sage to a couch so we can get to know each other better. I tell her about cheating on Ingrid and going to rehab, and she tells me about cheating on her poly boyfriend. When he found out, he said there was only one way she could make it up to him: to arrange to meet the other guy at a bar, go down on her boyfriend in the bathroom first, and then, when she met the guy, kiss him, spit her boyfriend's sperm into the guy's mouth, and tell him what it was. "I still feel really bad that I did it," she says, "but at the time I felt so guilty about cheating. I would have done anything to make it up to him." "I get it," I tell her. "I felt the same way." Whether or not swinging is for me, at least I found a world of people I'm comfortable with who appear to have both intimacy and openness. Plus, I found Nicole, Chelsea, and Sage. And I don't have to choose between them, which is ideal for an ambivalent. Nor do I have to keep my distance from someone I'm attracted to, just because she happens to be in a relationship at the moment. Though the cheating is a little worrisome, who am I to judge? At least this scene is more sensible than life after sex rehab, when women were triggers to be avoided rather than people to be enjoyed. As we're speaking, James rushes over and tells us that the group is leaving to go to an invitation-only after-party with an eyes-wide-shut theme. But first, he announces, I brought some party favors. We stop by his room, where he unzips a toiletries bag and pulls out a bottle of GHB. I've never done GHB, though I recall reading a disturbing article about a woman who was slipped some as a date rape drug on a cruise ship. Her system slowed down so much that she passed out, stopped breathing, and died. How do I know what dose to take? I ask James. He slices the air in an X pattern with an eyedropper like a wimpy Zorro. Don't worry, you're in good hands. Then make mine half the dose you're thinking of giving me, I tell him. GHB is odorless and tasteless. If he wants revenge for the laundry room incident with Nicole, now would be the perfect opportunity. You'll enjoy it, he says. It's like being drunk, but without the sloppiness. I'm sold. Nervous, but sold. In rehab, Troy and Adam asked me if I had any substance abuse problems, and I told them I wasn't into drinking or drugs. If I lose control, I feel like the person who comes out is unlikable. So I try to stay in control, I explained. And Troy slapped Adam on the back and proclaimed, See, I told you, he's definitely a sexaholic. I wasn't sure whether he was referring to my self-control or my self-esteem, but perhaps allowing myself to let go a bit would be good for me. James sucks a little GHB into the eyedropper, squeezes it into the bottle cap, and gives it to me to drink in some sort of erotic swingers rite. After 15 minutes, I feel a gentle wooziness, and then I remember something I'd meant to ask. As a guy, is this going to affect my, you know, performance? Come with me, James replies. I follow him to a table where there's a small medicine bottle filled with a thin syrup. This is liquid Viagra, he explains. It's only approved for testing on animals right now, but I got some online, and it's great because you can measure out the exact dosage. Want some? And there's nothing else in it? I ask. It's not going to make me trip or anything. I wonder why animals would want longer erections. It's just going to help you have a really fun night. Okay, but don't give me too much. I don't want to hurt anybody. He drops the Viagra into my mouth, and it tastes vile. We are ready to swing. Basically, these guys are ravers, but with sex instead of music. I wonder what I'm doing to myself. I suppose back in the late 60s, free love typically carried with it the implication of free drugs. And at least this is much more fun than hanging out with the Tantra Polys. Perhaps all these subcultures, going back before drunken Roman bacchanalia, have their own pre-sex ritual, conceived as a way of loosening inhibitions. I wonder why I was so resistant to the sacred rites of the Poly people, but I'm so open to the illicit chemical concoctions the swingers are giving me. It's definitely a moral failing on my part. We float into the hallway in a semi-euphoria and stop by a few very unswinging parties until finally, with the effect of the GHB already fading, we cross to the fantasy tower of the hotel for the Eyes Wide Shut party. Inside the bedroom suite, there's a DJ, a stripper pole, and in the center of the room, a conspicuous round table with a white sheet over it. Milling around are nearly three dozen shirtless men and women, wearing elaborate Mardi Gras masks. I've never seen more fake breasts in my life, even in a porn film. Oddly, no one is having sex. Near the entrance of the room, there's a large cardboard box full of costumes. Sage selects a black eye mask with colorful peacock feathers protruding from the corners. I grab a white mask with a long clockwork orange nose and a jester cap on top. Let's top off, James says. He measures out a cap of GHB for each of us, and then we wait for something to happen. It seems like everyone's waiting. There's an unacknowledged awkwardness in the room, like a high school prom with no one on the dance floor. Suddenly, I hear a pinched, gravelly male voice. "Hey, man, it's Neil Strauss." I turn around to see an unmistakable figure in a red bathrobe and a white mask. I can tell from his slinking posture and the stubbly, well-shaped jawline beneath the mask that it's Corey Feldman. "What are you doing at my party?" he asks. "This is your party?" I haven't seen Corey, best known as the teen actor in Stand By Me and The Lost Boys, in at least 7 years. I first met him while I was writing a book with Marilyn Manson, who had a minor obsession with Feldman that mostly involved mocking him. "What are you doing here?" he asks, equally shocked. As I tell him I'm new to the scene, in my peripheral vision, I see the blonde enchantress from the club. She's completely naked except for a Lone Ranger mask. She walks to the round table, turns around, sits on it, and spreads her legs wide. She then scoots backward and puts her feet up on the edge of the table, ratcheting her legs even wider. She freezes there alone, as if preparing to suck the entire room into her vagina. "So are you just in it for the numbers?" Corey asks. "It's a trick question. Men, it seems, like to test other men in the scene to make sure they're in it for the right reasons, whatever those may be. Fortunately, I'm not here to accumulate notches on my belt. I'm in it to find another way to live besides conventional monogamy," I answer. "Then this is the ultimate extreme," Corey replies enthusiastically. Evidently, I passed. In my peripheral vision, I notice a man approach the table, drop to his knees, and bury his face reverently between the blonde's legs. "Why is that?" I ask Corey. "Because seeing the person you love with someone else is the height of passion." "Yeah, but usually the passion it ignites in people is murderous." "That's the point. It's something that's hard to deal with. And normally, you would feel jealousy and anger. But if you can control it..." He presses his hand palm down from his heart to his crotch, as if resisting a huge weight, "and turn it into passion, it becomes a very connecting experience." A chorus of grunts and groans fills the room, and I look up to see three couples around the circular table. Two of the women are bending over the tabletop as guys slam them from behind. Everyone must have been waiting for someone with the courage to get the party started. However, it doesn't look like a giant swap meet or sex pile. Just couples having sex around other couples having sex. There was actually more swapping at the puja. Perhaps the high of swinging for some is just being in an atmosphere of sexual decadence. Suddenly, the second dose of GHB hits me. It's not a gentle wooziness like earlier, but a more aggressive takeover of my system. I'm lightheaded, dizzy, and almost happy enough to actually want to do a puja. "I put that table there on purpose," Corey says proudly, gesturing to the couples copulating against it. "There was a glass one, but we had them move it out and bring this one instead." I try to focus my brain and stop my eyeballs from spinning long enough to respond, "That was, very thoughtful." But for the life of me, I can't understand why a circular table is the key to an orgy. "I know what I'm doing," he replies immodestly. "I don't do drugs, but I make up for it with sex. Last night, I had sex with 6 different women." Thinking back on my interviews with Feldman, he was also enmeshed by his mom. In addition to making him rub her feet, comb her hair, and draw her baths when he was a child, she used him to fulfill her own ambitions for fame, going so far as to put him on diet pills when he was 14. Rick would tell me that I'm in a sexual crack house right now. The 3 signs of addiction, according to Joan, are that it's chronic, it's progressive, and it has life-damaging consequences. I don't think this is chronic for me yet, but it's definitely progressive. As for life-damaging consequences, the night is still young. A shirtless man sits next to us. His partner, a heavyset blonde with the fake breasts that are evidently requisite here, unzips his pants and starts giving him a blowjob. "Am I keeping you from joining in?" I ask Corey through the haze, hoping to make my escape. "No, I'm really picky," Corey replies. He He proceeds to tell me about a night he and a girlfriend spent in Pamela Anderson's hotel room, unsuccessfully trying to seduce her. Pamela Anderson has never even made out with a girl before, he continues. Can you believe that? And she told me that when she was on coke, so it must be true. My swinger pod appears next to us, and they seem antsy and ready to do something crazy. Don't worry about me, Corey says. Go have fun. I mumble and awkward, nice seeing you again, and rejoin the group. I instantly feel better now that I don't have to hide the fact that I'm so fucking high. It's time. This is an orgy I actually want to take part in, especially now that I have a partner I'm comfortable with. And I can't see myself getting kicked out, especially since I know the host and there's no popcorn in sight. I lean in to kiss Sage, but the nose on my mask pokes her in the face. I'm not sure if it's just the design of the mask or my dizziness. She giggles and cocks her head to the side to avoid the obstacle. As her lips approach mine, the feathers on her mask tickle my nose. I want to lose myself in our first kiss, but I feel like I'm going to sneeze. I pull back, and the pointy extensions on my jester hat poke James in the eyes. In the meantime, his mask is so elaborate that he can't kiss anyone. Sage and Chelsea start making out with each other, but their masks jab Tommy and me, so we back away. In Eyes Wide Shut, and every other movie with a decadent masked ball, the guests intermingle with grace, fluidity, and sensuality. But in actuality, it's impossible to kiss anyone without multiple noses, feathers, horns, and bells, poking, tickling, and obstructing. The result is more like a slapstick comedy. Let's just take these stupid masks off, Nicole finally says. Real life is never like the movies. Chapter 17. As I start to remove my mask, Sage whispers to me, "Leave it on." I'm not sure whether I should take it as an insult or a compliment, probably an insult, but I comply. Sage grabs my crotch and starts rubbing me through my pants, so I reach under her skirt. I hook my index finger inside her, and within minutes, a hissing sound escapes from between her legs, along with a stream of fluid. "She's a squirter," Chelsea exclaims, and suddenly, everyone has their hands on my date. "I'm going to scout for a more comfortable place," James offers. As the GHB intensifies, I look up and see couples fucking everywhere. Most of the masks are off now for practical reasons. As the swingettes go down on the guys they're with, or sit on top of them, they're doing more than just having sex. They're performing for everyone else in the room. James was right. This is much better than porn. "I found a free bed," James says. We make our way into one of the suite's bedrooms. I don't know what's about to happen, but between the GHB, the champagne, the liquid Viagra, the copulating couples everywhere, Nicole's legs, Chelsea's breasts, and Sage's orgasms, I couldn't be any more turned on. I just wish there were some way to get rid of the two guys. I don't know what their expectations are. I drop onto the bed, grateful for the softness. It soothes the dizziness. Sage climbs on top of me and starts grinding against me, while Chelsea strips down to just underwear and heart-shaped pasties. Tommy and James are stuck standing awkwardly on the side of the bed, so I slide over to make room for them. I don't know why. I'm in the middle of three scantily clad, ready-to-go, non-monogamous women. Why the fuck should I care about these guys' comfort? I would have paid every penny in the bank for this experience 10 years ago if I'd known it was even possible. Now, instead of enjoying it, I'm turning into a theater usher. Chelsea lies on the bed, petite and golden, with sculpted abs, her pasties thrust toward the ceiling. "Take care of her for me," Tommy tells me. "Define take care," I ask. This is my first real swinger party, so I'm unsure of the etiquette. I don't want to start fucking her, then find out he just meant to get her a pillow. Do whatever you want, James explains. You're the lead sled dog here. Just be safe, okay? Tommy whispers in my ear. They're literally offering their girls to me. When I was learning the game, I worked so hard for an opportunity with just one woman like this. Now there are three, and no stupid games, and will you still respect me in the morning fears. I'm so intoxicated by all the possibilities that I feel like I'm going to explode with excitement, desire, gratitude, lust. Or maybe it's just the GHB and Viagra. I don't know. I don't care. It's the closest thing to heaven I've ever experienced. Wake up. A male voice is yelling in my ear. I think it's James. I'm not sleeping, I hear my voice say. I'm not sleeping. I look up. My head feels like it's stuffed with wet toilet paper. Fuck. I think I passed out. Sage is sitting on top of me. Chelsea is on my side. She whispers sensuously in my ear. Can I help you with anything? That's so hospitable of her. She's like a Hooters waitress. Do they have food here? I ask. She leans in closer, her breasts rubbing against my chest, and says even more sensuously, whatever you want. Actually, just some water would be nice, I smile gratefully. She doesn't go anywhere or even make a motion to get any water, because clearly, at least to anyone not drugged up, she wants to help me with something else. In the dimness of my mind, a brain cell starts to illuminate. Pasties, I tell her. The word seems to expel from my mouth in slow motion. She looks at me confused. Those are nice pasties. Where did you get them? Why am I making small talk? I should tell her I need help with my dick or something. The regulator has come off my brain. This is why I don't like drugs. They make everyone cool but me. At least Sage is unzipping my pants right now. That's a reassuring... Wake up. It's that voice again, drilling into my ear. Why do you keep saying that? I ask. My eyes focus in the direction of the noise, revealing James again. I look up, and Sage is still on top of me, but she's laughing. You fell asleep on her, James tells me. You were snoring. You should be ashamed of yourself, falling asleep on a beautiful woman like that, Tommy chides. Are you joking? I ask. No, Sage confirms. I was going down on you, and you fell asleep and started snoring. I have absolutely no memory of falling asleep. That's terrifying. Now I see why this is a date rape drug. I want to ask how loudly I was snoring, but I'm afraid of the answer. Instead, I stupidly ask her, did I stay hard? Yes. Wow, that Viagra really works. I notice a line of guys standing against the wall in front of the bed, just watching us. Not only didn't I notice them before, but I haven't seen any other people being blatantly stared at here. I peel myself off the bed and nod my head, trying to clear out the toilet paper, which is whirling faster inside. I notice that my mask isn't on. I wonder where it went. James mumbles something I can't understand, but I can see he's handing me a folded breath strip. Maybe my breath reeks. He starts to place it in my mouth, but it feels a little too intimate. I can do it myself, I insist, taking it from him. Careful. He guides my hands toward my mouth so I don't drop it. That's two orgies ending in disaster. I'm like the orgy ruiner. The saddest thing is, I got more action here asleep than I did awake. I remember now another part of that article on GHB. The writer warned not to mix it with alcohol. As we start to leave, one of the guys who was watching earlier introduces himself. I run the bliss parties, he says. I'm very familiar with your work. I think you'll find this community very interesting. He points out another guy who was watching. He's actually here because of your books. And I realize that whole line of people against the wall, not only were they watching me humiliate myself, but they know who I am. I tell myself that maybe it's cool to pass out at an orgy. Like I've been to so many in my lifetime, they bore me. The promoter starts talking to me about how he scouts for talent for these parties. He'll go to clubs, watch couples and their dynamic together, then selectively recruit them. The formula is hot girls, he explains, and as long as the guy isn't a toad and doesn't have a jealousy switch, he's fine. Perhaps this is my scene, I think as James pulls me away. Just being able to go on a sexually decadent vacation like this, a couple of weekends a year, would probably be enough to make monogamy bearable the rest of the time. Kind of like the cheat day in a diet. This was supposedly one of the functions of ancient ritualistic orgies as well, to serve as a psychological release valve, alleviating the pain of human separateness. Should we go check out some other parties? James asks. I think I'm done for the night, I tell him. How are you going to get to sleep on E? I'm just not going to do any. Too late for that. What do you mean? You just took some. What? How could I have possibly taken ecstasy? Unless when I was passed out. But that would be fucked up to dose me while I'm sleeping. In the breath strip, he says. I thought you knew. I thought it was for my breath. Don't worry. It's really pure. The only problem is that while you're on it, you can't get it up. And it's dangerous to mix with too much Viagra. Then why are we doing this? I'm starting to think James may be completely crazy, like the Joker in Batman comics. This makes no sense. Doesn't that ruin the whole point of being here? No, because the girls like it, and they can still get turned on. So how long is this going to last? Probably 5 hours. Oh God, what have I done?
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.